Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Velkommen til Civitas podcast Liberal halvtime. Jeg heter Mathilde Fasting og dagens vert. Denne episoden spilles inn på engelsk og med Francis Fukuyama. Først så vil dere høre et ekstra klipp jeg har tatt opp med Francis Fukuyama på ettermiddagen torsdag den 24. februar, da Russland gikk inn i Ukraina. Det har vi gjort fordi at vi også i podcasten for øvrig snakker om Ukraina, og for så vidt også om andre spørsmål som har med dette å gjøre, men de altså tatt opp den 26. i første, altså 26. januar, slik at dette da nesten en måned senere, og det har skjedd mye på den internasjonale arenaen i denne perioden. Så først får dere altså høre et klipp med Francis Fukuyama. Det tatt opp når det morgen hos han, så han har da sovet gjennom alle disse timene hvor vi har hatt invasjon i Ukraina. Og deretter så får dere et opptak av samtalen vi hadde på Solstrand-programmet. Og da får jeg også si tusen takk til Solstrand-programmet, som la meg dele episoden der med dere, altså samtalen som vi har hatt der. Så da får dere først nå Francis Fukuyama, så velkommen til Liberal halvtime, og episoden da litt lengre enn den pleier å være, men jeg håper at dere synes det interessant og holder ut hele samtalen.
So, welcome to Liberal Halvtime. This is Mathilde Fasting calling, and I am talking to Francis Fukuyama today because we are the 24th of February, and we have recorded an episode about a month ago that you will soon be listening to. But since then, there has been huge things happening in Ukraine, and we woke up this morning, and there was actually Russian military forces entering into Ukraine, and now we are seeing pictures of bombing and of the things going on even in Kyiv. So, Frank, I know it's early in the morning, and I know that you have been watching the news, but what shall we say about this?
Well, thank you, Matilda. I think the first thing for me to say is that I have a lot of personal investment in Ukraine, because for the last several years, especially since 2013, my center at Stanford, the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law, has been running a lot of leadership programs for young, well, mid-career Ukrainians. It's our belief that Ukraine is really the front line in a global struggle over liberal democracy, and that if Ukraine didn't succeed, it would be very hard for democracy to succeed in other places. And I think what's happened, this tragic attack by Russia, demonstrates that that's true. I think that, you know, in the U.S., there's been this debate over, you know, whether the West isn't somehow responsible for what's happened because of NATO expansion that alienated the Russians and turned them on this nationalistic course. I think that the invasion shows that that's just nonsense, that, you know, even if you somehow felt threatened by NATO, your response to it is not to launch a major war that is going to have unpredictable consequences. I do think that President Putin, as opposed to Russia, is threatened by Ukraine, because he said very clearly that he does not believe that, you know, a Slavic people can really have a democracy, that authoritarian government is somehow deeply embedded in Russian culture. And he's moreover said that he doesn't believe that Ukraine is a sovereign, independent country. It's really part of Russia. And that the whole independence of Ukraine was from the start. I mean, this is what he said in his speech a couple of days ago, that this was just an accidental mistake by Vladimir Lenin, and it needs to be corrected. And none of this takes account of the actual wishes of the nearly 40 million, you know, inhabitants of Ukraine. And so I think that, you know, the real threat that he has faced is the possibility that Ukraine could succeed as a democracy. I don't see how other democracies in other parts of the world can let him get away with this. to deliberately, you know, undermine, you know, a democratic experiment. I'm actually relatively happy with the response that the West has made so far. I was quite surprised, actually, that the Germans agreed to cancel Nord Stream 2 very early on, since they had seemed to be quite reluctant to do that. We'll have to see about the level of sanctions. But, you know, right now, nobody is calling on any other country to fight on Ukraine's behalf. But I do think that we owe it to them to give them as much support, both economically and militarily, as possible, because they are perfectly willing to fight on for themselves. We've talked to a lot of our friends and colleagues in Ukraine over the past couple of weeks, and, you know, they're all taking weapons training and they're getting ready to wage whatever kind of warfare needs to be done in order to stop the Russians. I guess the last thing I would say is that, you know, the Biden administration circulated this list that the intelligence services had picked up about, you know, individuals that will be targeted if Russia can install a puppet government in Kiev or run it directly themselves. And basically, a lot of our friends, you know, civil society activists, anti-corruption campaigners, human rights defenders, journalists, a lot of them are on that list. And so this is actually quite a personal matter to me that will affect, you know, the welfare of a lot of my friends and colleagues. So, you know, I think at this point we can only hope for the best, but kind of understand that this is not a faraway place that is irrelevant. Russia and Putin, well, I wouldn't say Russia, but Putin wants to basically overturn the entire shift towards a Europe whole and free that emerged at the end of the Cold War. And we basically cannot allow him to do this.
So, but right now we see that there are casualties, and we know probably that that the Russian forces will be able to take over the main cities. So, do you have any thoughts of what will happen the next days and weeks?
I actually don't know that Russia's plan is to occupy the whole country. They actually don't have nearly the manpower to do that. I mean, Kiev by itself has got almost 3 million people living in it. Simply, you know, controlling that city, I think, is something that's probably beyond their abilities. I think what they want to do is, first of all, destroy as much of Ukraine's military as possible. And I think people need to focus on the Black Sea, because Ukraine is a major, major agricultural exporter. All of its grain leaves from these Black Sea ports, like Mariupol and Odessa. And it's interesting that one of the first targets of this Russian attack was the port of Odessa. And I think what they'd like to do is kind of minimally occupy certain strategic points like those ports, and then, you know, use that to strangle Ukraine economically. And that's where we've got to have a counter strategy, because I don't think that we've been really focused on, you know, for example, how do you get grain out of southern Ukraine so that, you know, Ukraine doesn't die on the vine economically. And that's the kind of issue I think we're going to be facing in the coming days and weeks.
And finally, the sanctions, you said you were pleased, and especially the Nord Stream we have been talking about earlier. Are there other things you think, or what do you think Putin's reactions will be to this? Because will he I've seen small articles saying that he's really shrugging and not saying it doesn't work, and he doesn't care about that. But what do you think?
Well, I think that's probably true. You know, he's been planning to do this for a long time. Russians have a lot of reserves. Their economy is not as weak as many people have asserted. And especially the people around him, you know, they're called the Siloviki, the power people close to Putin, are the ones that are least exposed. You know, they're not the ones that have these big flats in London and so forth. And so they don't actually care that much about these Western sanctions. However, you know, kicking Russia out of the SWIFT payment system, international payment system, is going to have a big effect on their banking system, and that will hurt a lot. But, you know, I'm afraid that they're prepared for this and they're going to tighten their belts and try to get through it. I think the bigger problem will be, you know, if they start taking significant casualties in this military operation. That was really what undermined their stay in Afghanistan. And I think that's still a big issue domestically in Russia. So we'll just have to see how this goes.
Well, thank you, Frank. We are continuing this podcast by talking about your coming book. And I guess people will just have to read, as I said in the introduction there, your articles in American Purpose. And you also now have a podcast, I know, for Stanford. So I guess the listeners could listen to you then, and we'll have to follow what happens during the next weeks. And it's really, really, really a sad day for Europe and for the world, and especially for the Ukrainians. So thank you, Erlin. In the morning,
yes.
Frank.
Well, thank you, Matilda. It's a great honor to be back at Solstrand for a second year, and I'm looking forward to a good discussion. So before I explain why I wrote the book, you know, maybe some definitions are in order. You know, the United States, Norway, France, Germany are all liberal democracies. And in that kind of a political system, there's actually joined together two different sets of institutions. So the democratic ones are things like free and fair multi-party elections. But the liberal part of liberal democracy really has to do with a structure of rules, laws, constitutions, and the like that limit the power of the government. And the idea is really to create a balanced system in which the state is strong enough to do necessary things like deal with a pandemic or deal with national defense or keep order in the streets. But it's also limited by law so that it only operates within the framework of law. And between these two, excuse me, they've been supported by different groups in society. Generally speaking, liberalism predated democracy. It really arose in the 17th century in Europe after the European Wars of Religion. And the basic idea was that if we base our political system on agreement on a set of final ends as defined by religion, then we're going to fight. We're not going to be able to reconcile these views because people disagree on what those final ends are. And, you know, at that time, the big conflict was after the Reformation between Protestants and Catholics. But there are many other, you know, types of religious conflicts that liberalism seeks to moderate. For example, in India today, India had created a liberal constitution after it was founded in the 1940s. But today, Prime Minister Modi of the BJP is trying to shift Indian national identity to one based on Hinduism. There's about 200 million Muslims in India, as well as Christians and other people that are not Orthodox Hindus. And what it's doing is creating the grounds for, you know, violence against a religious minority. And that's what happens when you abandon these liberal constraints on power. So democracy by itself can actually be a dangerous thing if people agree that they're going to take away the rights of particular people. And this is what happened in the United States historically under slavery and then under legal segregation. Then you're not going to enjoy the liberal, you know, the advantages of a liberal society in which people tolerate one another despite these kinds of differences. I think that the success of Europe after 1945 was the result of the creation of liberal institutions. You know, Europe had fallen into two horrendous world wars based on
aggressive forms of nationalism. And just like the conflicts in the 17th century over religion, these conflicts over national identity, over race and ethnicity proved to be, you know, incredibly violent. And the European Union, in a sense, was created on a liberal basis to regulate those sorts of conflicts and to say, we're not going to agree on national identity necessarily, but we are going to create rules that will constrain the behavior of different political actors. And that's the world that we've been living in ever since the late 1940s, a liberal international order. One of the big advantages of liberalism actually has to do with economics, because liberal societies create rules, they create rights, and then they enforce those rights. And among the rights, you know, you have a right to speech, you have a right to believe, you have a right to associate, but you also have a right to own property. And I think that the prosperity of the modern world really depends on liberal regimes that have enforced property rights. So, for example, Singapore today is not a liberal democracy. They don't really have free and fair elections, but they do have a liberal legal order. They've got a very strong law that's derived from British common law, and it means that companies investing in Singapore are pretty secure in their property rights. And I would say even China, as it opened up to the world, did so by adopting liberal principles of property rights, of respect for, let's say, a foreign company that invested, you know, $100 million in a plant in China. You know, they'd want to know that the Chinese government wasn't going to take it away from them the next year. And so there were liberal aspects even to the Chinese system, despite the fact that they had no democracy. So now, after this big windup, I'll get to answering your question. The reason I wrote this book is that liberalism is under attack today. I think that for the last 70 years, most of us have been taking liberal principles for granted, that we want to live under rule of law regimes that treat individuals with equal respect and equal dignity, but they are being challenged from both the right and the left. I think the challenge from the right is more immediate and probably bigger, because you see the growth of illiberalism in places like Hungary, in the heart of the European Union. So Viktor Orban has publicly declared that what he's trying to do in Hungary is to establish an illiberal democracy. He's elected. I mean, we'll see next year whether he can actually get reelected. But for the past decade, he's been elected by a substantial majority of Hungarian voters. But he's not respected any of the rules regarding freedom of the press, you know, treatment, equal treatment of property. He's pushed out groups that oppose his rule. And all of these are violations, not of democratic principles so much as violations of liberal principles. And then we get to the United States. You know, the United States was probably the biggest and most important liberal society. It was liberal before it was democratic, before the Revolutionary War and American independence. And that liberalism has been severely challenged by Donald Trump and the rise of his populist movement. You know, one of the first things Donald Trump did was he threatened that he would lock up Hillary Clinton. And, you know, he kept urging his attorney general to go after political opponents. And that's not the way a liberal justice system works. In a liberal society, you have a rule of law. You have a judiciary and prosecutors that are in charge of enforcing the laws, and they're not available as weapons to be used by politicians. Now, this happens in many countries, in many developing democracies, but the rule of law tradition in the United States up till now has been extremely strong, and unfortunately, it's starting to come unravel. I think the biggest violation of liberal rules that happened was the refusal of Donald Trump to concede that he lost the 2020 election. And we now know that he was involved in it was kind of clumsy, but it was a clear, multi-layered effort to overturn that election by getting Vice President Pence to declare that Joe Biden wasn't the winner of the election. This is just completely unprecedented. Since the Civil War, we've not had an election that produced this kind of completely fraudulent charge on the part. In fact, even during the Civil War, the losing side admitted that they lost the election, but we've never had the case of a losing candidate who refused to admit that he actually lost. This is the sort of thing that happens in young democracies, and yet it's happened in the United States. And right now, I think we are facing a really big political crisis because after January 6th, the people who believe that the election had been stolen have basically taken over the Republican Party. And so all of the responsible leaders of that party feel that they have to endorse Trump's view that the election was stolen. And this really undermines, I think, the respect for rules and for law in the country. But there's also a threat, I think, coming from the left, because liberalism, as it's classically been defined, is based on a premise of human equality, that all human beings may differ culturally, by language, by race, gender, and so forth. But underneath those characteristics, there is a certain core of humanity that is really based on the ability to make moral choices. And in that sense, all people are created equal. The U.S. Declaration of Independence says, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. If you think, you know, what does that mean? How can you possibly believe that human beings are equal? They're obviously not equal in strength, in skin color, in intelligence, and a lot of other characteristics. But I think the idea underlying a liberal society is that there is a moral core to every individual, and that the government needs to respect that by giving people equal rights. And this has been challenged really on the left with the rise of identity politics, where increasingly people say, well, we're not really equal because of the historical legacies of racism and sexism. Everybody's experience is different. White people can't understand what it's like to be an African American. They shouldn't try. They don't understand, you know, the racism in their own actions. And similar things are said about gender and so forth. And so you have a situation in which many people in this, you know, in this cultural moment actually want to, you know, they care more about asserting these identities than they do about things like freedom of speech and due process. And so you've seen these sorts of attacks on liberal principles unfolding, mostly in places like university campuses and the media, in elite media publications and the like. So I think, you know, those are the reasons I wrote the book. We're under threat. Those liberal principles are under threat, and I think they need to be defended. Sorry, I took too long in that answer.
No, that's fine. You took a lot of answers, and I think that if you look into your first book, The End of History book, of course, that was just after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And some of those things that you mentioned in that book, you are still mentioning today. So it's kind of a red thread that people, if they read the whole End of History book, they will see that you had some, I wouldn't say optimistic views, but you had some views that said that maybe this is not going to be fine all the time, because, and then I believe that the most important and the most dangerous thing for you was those threats that you have started telling us now, the internal threats, people not believing in being on common ground, on being in a nation or in it together, and that minimum of respecting each other is just about to disappear. And if you look at the situation in the US right now, that's probably I believe what you are trying to explain here, that that will take you in an illiberal direction, and by ruining institutions, but also ruining all those things that you call the soft things. So maybe you could go into a little bit about, we are reading, you mentioned university campuses, and sometimes in the debate in Norway, and also, of course, in the US, you hear about critical theory, woke, cancel culture, those things that I mean, it's all about how we are talking to each other and what we can say and not say, and all those things that maybe not written in the law book, but it's there and it's important. So I'd like to hear your views on that.
Sure. So I think that this issue of identity politics is, you know, it's less prominent in Europe than it is in the United States. And I think there's a good reason for that, which is really America's very troubled racial history, where you had slavery and then segregation and, you know, the formal mistreatment of a very important minority of citizens by the government. And so I think it's made Americans particularly sensitive to those kinds of issues. Now, you know, we just actually in this country celebrated the Martin Luther King holiday. And it's very interesting what's happened in the way that people on the left think about equality, because if you listen to Martin Luther King's speeches from those days in the 1960s, he said, we Black Americans simply want to be treated equally. We don't want any special privileges. We simply want the same rights that are enjoyed by white Americans. And that was really the basis of the civil rights movement. So he accepted, you know, the premise, the liberal premise, that there's a fundamental equality underlying everybody. There's a famous line in his speech at the Lincoln Memorial when he says, you know, I look forward to a day when little Black children will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their characters. And that points directly to this liberal premise that, you know, what makes us equal is this ability to have moral choice. But, you know, that actually now has been explicitly rejected by a lot of people who are promoting a certain form of identity politics. I mean, identity politics can actually serve liberal ends if it's simply a mechanism for mobilizing marginalized groups to demand equal rights. And that's really what happened in the US in the civil rights movement. But, you know, today you have, you know, people on the left that are saying, you know, it's an illusion that there's anything like equality, that we have to think in racial and gender terms right from the beginning, because we aren't equal and we will never be equal. We live in a patriarchal, you know, racist society. It runs so deep that, you know, it permeates every aspect of what we do. And even if you think you're not racist, you actually are, because you're perpetuating structures that lead to unequal outcomes between people. And, you know, it directly gets at the liberal premise of equality, that they're essentially saying, you know, we're not equal. Our lived experiences are so different that, you know, you're never going to understand me because of this this kind of divide. And so I think that's really what's happened, that, you know, identity politics has evolved from something that was the fulfillment of the promise of a liberal society, that is to say, equality under the law, and it's turned into something that's not liberal. Now, there's a lot of other things you can say about modern identity politics. It's extraordinarily sensitive to language. I have a chapter in my book. You know, I actually, when I was younger, right out of university, I went to Paris and I studied with Jacques Derrida and Roland Barthes and a lot of the, you know, at that time, the postmodernist French thinkers. So I'm very familiar with this line of thought. And, you know, I think probably the most decisive figure was Michel Foucault, who, in a way, created the intellectual framework by which many people on the left understand the nature of politics, because Foucault said that in a supposedly liberal society, there are actually hierarchies and oppression, but unlike the old days when authoritarians could simply use power openly, they don't do that anymore. They use language in order to keep people subordinated. For example, the way that you speak about, a gay or a lesbian, if you use a certain kind of word, to describe them, it's very demeaning and it reinforces, their exclusion from the rest of society. And I think that this has led to kind of this extraordinary sensitivity on the part of progressive people today over, names, over statues, over commemorations of past historical events, and over the way we identify ourselves. So I don't know whether this goes on in Norway, but certainly among my students, if you send an email to somebody, a lot of people will say, my name is Francis Fukuyama, and then in parentheses, him, his, to indicate that I'm a cisgender male and I don't identify as a woman. This sort of thing, I think, strikes a lot of people that are not on the left as very bizarre, that you need to do this. But even, something seemingly harmless, like the use of a gender pronoun, is seen as discriminatory, because if you say just his or him without that modification, you're asserting that, your biological sex is really determines your gender, and you're not open to the possibility that, you could be a different gender, and you're not respectful to people whose gender, they believe is not the one they were born with. And so, that's the kind of sensitivity that, we see today that really does, I think, come out of a lot of this postmodernist thought.
Yeah, and I can say that most of these things that's in the forthcoming book, it's described very well there. But there's another thing if you go back to economics, because when you say that liberalism and its discontents, it's also, I believe in your book, you are aware of some of the criticism that has come around for liberalism. Is also it's due. It's okay to do it, and it should be done, and it's correct to do it. For instance, if we take the economics, and you have a chapter on neoliberalism and also things that happened economically, and also what's happened with globalization and trade and inequality and so forth, and what politicians could have done and they haven't done. So maybe take us through a little bit of those arguments that you kind of agree on, and also if you have some other points that they should have been aware
of. Well, it's actually at the beginning of the book. It's two chapters actually at the beginning about how economic liberalism became neoliberalism beginning in the late 1970s and 80s. So as I said, liberalism is very good for economic growth because it protects property rights and freedom of contract under a system of law, which is why liberal societies were the first to develop rapidly in the Industrial Revolution and beyond. What happened in the 1980s was that this preference for market-based solutions became kind of a religion, and opposition to the state became part of that doctrine. This was led by a number of Nobel Prize-winning economists like Milton Friedman or Gary Becker, Robert Lucas. A lot of them were associated with the University of Chicago. They made serious arguments. And in fact, I think it was the case that many Western economies were overregulated at that time. And that had a lot to do with, the kind of stagnation that the Western world experienced after the oil crises in the early 1970s, and then high rates of inflation and so forth. So there was something to this argument, but I think that in the succeeding generation, it got carried to an extreme where, the market was praised indiscriminately and the state was vilified. And so you had a lot of countries, for example, that believed in privatization, even in cases of things like natural monopolies, like a water system or an electrical grid in a city, and tried to sell these off to private investors under the assumption that private sector investors always do better than governments. And this led to some real awful outcomes. Mexico in the 1980s privatized Telmex and sold it to a gentleman named Carlos Slim, who is today one of the richest men in the world, because basically he took a public monopoly owned by the state and turned it into a private monopoly without any competition. And so Mexican, telephone service and prices are, the service is not good and the prices are among the highest in the world because of this kind of ideological belief that private ownership and markets are always better. And I think that what happened is that, in the succeeding decades, you had the spread of a globalization in which economic efficiency began to trump every other social value. So, if you had a factory and you could hire a worker for a few pennies an hour less in another country, you would take your investment and move it to that country. A lot of the discontent, I think, that's driving populism right now really emerged after China entered the World Trade Organization in the early 2000s and suddenly opened up the global market to very cheap labor that was quite capable of outcompeting workers, relatively low-skilled workers in Western countries. And so there was a massive surge of deindustrialization, unemployment, and so forth. And it's really in those areas that you see, the strongest support for populist policies, because this is preeminently a case where the populists are right. You had elites, meaning corporations, owners of capital, that took advantage of globalization at the expense of workers. And, they didn't really think about the political implications of what they were doing. And so that's, the sense in which this belief in free markets, I think, was taken way too far.
Yeah, we can. Today we are also going to touch on, of course, China in a little while. We'll just finish your book first before going to go international and go through conflicts and areas internationally that are really important, including, of course, Ukraine. But we'll come to that in a little while. But before we leave your book, I would like to comment or have your comments on another person that you are criticizing. And that's probably a person that's, I'm not sure how well known it is for the audience. So maybe you'll just give us a little context of what he wrote. It's John Rawls, and you have critics of him, and it's important. It's some of the core critic points you have in your book here. Explain why you wanted to include John Rawls, who he is and what he said, and why you think his influence, if I could say so, is a problem or has been a problem.
Sure. So Rawls is probably the dominant liberal philosopher. He was a professor at Harvard that wrote a book called A Theory of Justice back in the 1970s that became kind of the standard theoretical justification for a certain kind of liberalism. What I say in my book is that Rawls did to liberal political theory what the neoliberals did to liberal economic theory. That is, he took it to an extreme that then became unsupportable. So as I said, liberalism is based on a certain view of human beings, that they have moral cores. They can make choices for better or for worse. And that's what a liberal society tries to protect by giving them rights to have their own opinions, to vote, you know, to live where they want, to marry who they want, you know, and the like. Rawls basically took this idea of individual autonomy and stretched it, I think, to an unsupportable length where autonomy became the only good that trumped every other good. You know, so if you think about it, we who live in a liberal society enjoy the fact that we can make these choices, but we also have moral commitments. You know, we have religious beliefs. We have cultural practices that we've inherited from our ancestors. We have a lot of informal rules that give structure to our lives and provide us with community. And basically, you know, Rawls said, you know, none of these other rules other than the protection of autonomy are legitimate in a liberal society, that nobody can tell anybody else how to live because autonomy by itself is, you know, the essence of liberalism. And what it does is it strips, you know, really, it kind of makes this moral core meaningless if all you is a choosing individual, but you know, what you choose is completely secondary. You know, whether you choose to be public spirited, generous, brave, or you choose to be selfish, you know, self-involved, and the like. According to Rawls, these are not things that anybody can say anything about, because as long as you don't impede somebody else's right to make similar choices, in a liberal society, you can't say that certain ways of life are better than others. And I think this completely contradicts most people's understanding of morality. You know, they don't think morality is just about the naked ability to choose. They think that it means living in a certain moral tradition. So, you know, for many people, that is defined by religion. And in a liberal society, you don't outlaw religion. You allow the free exercise of religion, as the American First Amendment says, because, you know, I think there was a recognition by these early liberal theorists like John Locke that, you know, our moral commitments are very important to us. And therefore, what you want to promote is religious tolerance, but not eliminate religion as a commitment. And I think that's the step that Rawls takes. You know, he says that basically the ability to choose and to choose differently trumps any kind of moral commitment, and therefore the society cannot, you know, express an opinion about right and wrong other than these basic rules of justice.
Yeah. So, well, the big problem is, of course, how you can have a society with lots of different views, lots of different meaning diversity in every sense, and keep it all together. So coming into the final chapter of your book, you have two final chapters. There's one on national identity, and the other one is what you call principles for a liberal society. So before we leave your book and go over to matters that are around us in the world right now, just give us those principles and tell us what you mean by national identity and how this can be reconciled with the liberal universal principle of that we have in, for instance, international organizations and what we need for international institutions.
Well, there would seem to be a contradiction between liberal theory and liberal practice, because liberals believe that all human beings are fundamentally equal and that they should enjoy equal rights no matter where they live or, you know, what they look like or what their race or ethnic group or gender. And in fact, that's stated explicitly in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was promulgated in the 1940s. But the world is divided up into nation states. And, you know, by and large, we don't pay as much attention to defending the rights of people that live outside of the boundaries of our state as much as we care about, you know, the protection of rights of those inside it. So the question is, how do you reconcile these? And in Europe in particular, you know, national identity and nationalism came to have such a bad reputation as a result of the events of the first half of the 20th century that on the left, there's a a kind of real resistance to talking about national identity, you know, that somehow this is a right-wing, you know, conservative idea, and that a really progressive person has to be a global cosmopolitan and worry about, you know, rights universally and not just in his or her own country. And, you know, so I spend a fair amount of time explaining why it's still important that the world be divided into nation states. And that really has to do with power, because, you know, what a modern liberal democracy is a kind of balance that on the one hand, you have a state, which is necessary. The state does things. It protects people internally and externally. It delivers services, education. It builds roads, bridges. It protects public health. On the other hand, you have these constraints in the form of rule of law and democratic choice that tell the state, no, you can't just do anything you want. And ideally, you want those to be in balance. But the power part is something that a lot of liberals don't like to think about, you know, the fact that you actually do need to enforce laws at a certain point. So if you look at the European Union, you know, who enforces a law? It's ultimately police, you know, prosecutors, ultimately, you know, military forces. And the European Union has a lot of, you know, nice liberal laws, but zero enforcement power. And so when you run into a severe crisis like the euro crisis or the refugee crisis in 2014, you know, Europe by itself really couldn't force any of its members to obey its own rules. Greece, in the case of the former, and then, you know, places like Hungary in the refugee crisis, because it basically, you know, is only legal constraints and some degree of democracy through the European Parliament. And if you really want to enforce rules, you ultimately still have to rely on nation states, you know, at a national level. And I just don't see any way that you can get beyond this in the current global situation. You know, a lot of people, a lot of my friends actually talk about global governance to meet the climate crisis. And there's no question that you need a lot of cooperation in order to deal with, you know, a crisis this severe. But, you know, what they want is to actually cede real coercive power to an international organization, right? So today, COP26 can't enforce anything. It's just a matter of voluntary agreement. But what people are talking about is actually creating an international organization that could, you know, force a country that wasn't obeying the climate rules to, you know, to do that. And I just think that this is a very dangerous thing to do, because you're creating a global executive and you're not really putting it under the kinds of constraints that a national level executive has, that is to say law and democratic accountability. And then furthermore, you can't set up this kind of an international system if you don't have a basic consensus over, you know, not just interests, but, you know, values like a democracy. And right now, you know, that's why the UN can't do anything, because you've got the United States, Britain, France, and then Russia and China, and you can't actually get them to agree on any kind of serious enforcement of security matters, because those five countries are in fundamental disagreement. In fact, they're competing with one another. So this is why I think that nation states still remain important. But these nations have to be built around different principles, and their identities cannot be based on things like ethnicity or religion or race, because, you know, we are de facto diverse societies. And as liberal societies, we have to be open to people that are different from us. And that's why I think, you know, we've got this difficult task of constructing a national identity that isn't simply, you know, grounded in race or ethnicity, but something that's grounded in, you know, liberal principles.
Yeah, and that's the very, very difficult part. People can read about that in your book and also in your other books, Identity, for instance. But let's now go to we are coping with the pandemic. And last time you and I saw each other was before the pandemic. We didn't know that just a few weeks after it would all be locked down. But on top of the situation, we have Ukraine, and that's disturbing. And you know Ukraine well. So I'd like your thoughts on that situation and, of course, the roles of those players that are discussing Ukraine and are threatening Ukraine right now. It's Russia, it's NATO, it's the EU, and it's the US. And for the listeners and for you in the audience, Frank just wrote a blog yesterday, I believe, or 2 days ago, about his thoughts about Ukraine. But just tell us what you think about that situation, and then you can come on to also discuss and tell us what Ukrainians say, because you've been talking to them for quite a long while, for many years, actually. So
yeah, my center at Stanford runs quite a few training programs for mid-career Ukrainians. And so we've been at this, you know, for quite a few years now. And I really know a lot of young reformers in that country. So first of all, the threat to Ukraine right now is not coming from NATO or the US or anybody on that side of the divide. It's coming from Russia. And I think that, you know, there's been this decline of democracy around the world over the last 15, 16 years. And that has a international and a national component. The national component is the rise of populist parties, you know, people like Donald Trump. But the international part of it is the rise of these big authoritarian powers, basically Russia and China. I mean, you have some mid-sized powers like Turkey and Iran that are also in this game, but it's really these two big powers that really want to undermine the liberal international order. And Putin in particular, I think, wants to roll back the entire European settlement that unfolded after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. So, you know, to begin with, he said that Ukraine is really not a separate country. It's really part of a greater Russia. There's no difference between Ukrainians and Russians. But beyond that, you know, they've made demands that NATO not just say that it will not admit further new members, but basically will forswear the defense of any of the former Warsaw Pact countries. So essentially withdraw from the Czech Republic, Poland, the Baltic states, you know, Romania, Bulgaria, and so forth, and essentially recognize that as part of a Russian sphere of influence. So I think that, you know, the thing that made 1991 very hopeful was the fact that all of these countries that had been satellites of the former Soviet Union were now free, and they could actually decide their own, you know, national narratives without this kind of external compulsion by Russia. And this is really what's at stake for Europe. The Russians want to turn back these gains and essentially say, no, you know, you're not free to make these decisions. You have to respect, you know, our opinions. And if we want you to be part of a Russian, you know, larger Russia, then it's not your choice. You know, we're simply going to impose this by force. So I think there's a very, you know, and then I guess the final thing, you referred to my blog post, but it really has to do with Ukraine itself. You know, Ukraine is a genuine liberal democracy. I have no doubt about that. People in Ukraine are incredibly free. You know, they can write, they can criticize, they can make fun of the president, they can organize. There's a vibrant civil society. There's a, you know, a largely free press. You know, the problem there is really that the economy is controlled by a group of six or seven oligarchs who made their money at the time of the collapse of the former Soviet Union. They're very corrupt, and they've kind of kept a chokehold on the Ukrainian economy. But, you know, this younger generation of Ukrainians has been struggling against this, and they've made some real gains over the last over the period since 2014 and the you know, the revolution of dignity. So I just think that Ukraine is now the frontline state in a global struggle over democracy. If Russia is able to attack Ukraine and seize a part or all of it, basically every other country all the way up to the borders of Germany is going to feel, you know, under threat. And I think this is an intolerable thing. And that's why I think we need to do whatever we can to strengthen, you know, Ukraine's ability to defend itself.
Yeah, it's difficult. I didn't mean that NATO and the EU were threats, but actually I wanted to hear if you have any comments on their role in this game.
You know, the country that's been the most disappointing is really Germany, because, you know, Germany is the most important player within the European Union and the most important European player. Well, I don't know, maybe not in NATO, because you have Britain as well. But, you know, the Germans are really critical. I was talking to a German colleague yesterday who had been a high official in the German government. And, you know, he says that the problem is that in Germany, there are many people who are living, you know, in a complete fantasy land where basically talking to people will get them to be more reasonable. And that, you know, you can solve all problems through diplomacy, and that they fail to recognize that there are countries that simply don't care about that. You know, I mean, they'll use diplomacy to get their way, but if they want to use military force, they're going to do that without any compunction. And I think the Russians have shown already in Georgia, where they're occupying Abkhazia and South Ossetia in Ukraine, where they're occupying the Donbass, in Moldova, where they've got a chokehold over the Moldovan economy. You know, the Russians are going to use force to get their way to restore the former Soviet Union if they can. And I think they perceive that there's been this huge shift in what they call the correlation of forces, that compared to 2008, when the Bush administration wanted to take Georgia and Ukraine into NATO, the United States has been weakened by the financial crisis, by polarization. Europe is indecisive. They don't have a good decision-making structure. And some of Europe's leading countries are really not interested in any form of, you know, military confrontation. And, you know, I think Putin just sees this as a big opportunity to roll back the gains that democracy made in the 1990s. And that's really his, you know, his calculation right now.
Well, it's gloomy.
By the way, in Scandinavia, it's very interesting because both Sweden and Finland have made noises in the past few weeks about the possibility of actually joining NATO. And so I think, and certainly in the Baltics, they're completely realistic about the threat they face. I mean, if Russia, you know, moves further beyond Ukraine, they're going to be the first states that will lose their freedom. And so I think that there is, you know, a greater degree of realism in your part of the world than there is in, you know, in other parts of Europe, particularly in Germany.
Yeah, I read a poll with the answers from the Finns and from Swedes on the NATO question, and that's going up for joining. It's the first time, so you're probably right on that. But and it's of course threatening because Russia, as I told you before, we have borders with Russia in Norway, so it's quite close to us, even not in the Ukrainian direction, but in the other direction. So. But then again, another country that you would need to talk about, and that's, of course, with business and with people sitting here in the audience as well, is China. And you you mentioned the rise of China. And I also saw that on your blog, you quite often mentioned China and the problems that might arise with Taiwan and the situation that's far away from us, but even it's coming closer with this globalized world. So what are your takes on China? The moment?
Well, China, since 2013, has been evolving in a totalitarian direction. You know, I think in the first decade of the 21st century, they were a kind of ordinary authoritarian power. They didn't have democratic elections, but individual Chinese citizens had a fair degree of freedom to travel, to think, to speak, and so forth. But ever since Xi Jinping became the Chinese president, he's tightened the control of the Chinese Communist Party on virtually all aspects of Chinese society. And he's rolled back the kinds of freedoms that they used to enjoy. And he's also really shifted Chinese foreign policy. So previously, under Deng Xiaoping and his immediate successors, China said, we're concentrating on our domestic development. We're not going to try to spread our power and influence, and we're not going to try to spread our model to other countries. But after Xi came to power, this all reversed. And so they basically grabbed a huge part of the South China Sea. There's no country in the world that believes they have a legitimate claim to that part of the Pacific Ocean, but they're building military bases and fortifying these artificial islands that they've created. They've gotten into big territorial disputes with many of their neighbors, Japan and India, to begin with. And they've also made pretty clear that they want to reincorporate Taiwan and that they would like to do this, obviously, peacefully. But if that wasn't going to happen, they were willing to consider the use of force. And I think that most people are not sufficiently aware. They're still living in the world that existed 10 years ago or 15 years ago. They don't understand that actually China's ambitions have grown dramatically since then. Its military power has also grown dramatically, and that war in East Asia is a real possibility in a way that it wasn't in these earlier periods. And this, I think, particularly for Europeans who are just used to seeing China as a big market and an investment opportunity, it doesn't compute because it's not part of, the way they understood China up to this point. But I'm afraid that, in that country as well as in Russia, that's the direction we're moving in. Now, I would say that the one saving grace is that Xi Jinping and the Chinese leadership are simply not risk takers the way Putin is. Putin has taken unbelievable risks, sending troops to Venezuela and Syria and the like, and this buildup with Ukraine. The Chinese leadership has similar kinds of ambitions, but they are actually, more cautious. But that's not going to necessarily protect Taiwan forever because, they've said pretty clearly in the long run, they do expect that they will reincorporate that country.
Hmm. Yeah, and talking about leadership, the audience here, they are leaders, and you have in many instances talked about the importance of leadership, especially political leadership, obviously. And we have mentioned now a couple of leaders. You have Orban and you have Putin, like figures, and you have then Xi with another profile. And of course, you have your two last presidents, Donald Trump and Biden. So maybe you could reflect a bit on leadership and how important actually a person could be on top of everything, either it's in the business or if it's in politics.
Yeah, I run a whole bunch of leadership training programs all over the world. And my theory of change is really based on the importance of leadership, that you don't get significant change. You need several things in order to get change, right? So you need an idea for what you want to do. You need strong support from stakeholders. You need grassroots mobilization. But, you also have to have a leader that can put all of this together and use the mobilized stakeholders to actually bring the change about. And I think that, we can see, I wrote an article in 2020 about what the pandemic was teaching us about who is doing well and who is doing poorly. And, part of it is state capacity to deal with a health emergency. Part of it had to do with geography and other things that you can't do anything about. But leadership was incredibly important. And so Brazil and Mexico and the United States were all led by populist leaders who simply did not take the epidemic seriously. And that, I think, contributed very strongly to their, you know, much, much higher death rates in the first year of the pandemic. And so I think it's just, you know, blindingly obvious that that kind of leadership matters a great deal. It's not sufficient by itself to keep a country safe, but it is, you know, pretty important in terms of the final outcomes. And right now, you know, we're facing a, you know, a real crisis globally because you don't see very many international leaders that are, you know, willing to take up the mantle. I think everybody was hoping that Biden would restore the United States to its former role as the leading, you know, liberal internationalist power. I think he wants to do that, but his ability to actually deliver on that, we're seeing now, is, you know, is unfortunately limited. So that's, you know, I guess that's the way I would answer the question of how important leaders are. I'd say the answer is very important.
Yeah, and just going on Biden and the presidency of Joe Biden, and of course the upcoming midterm that you have in the U.S. in about, well, in a half a year or so, and further on, which scenarios you see for 2022 and the consequences of different scenarios, if you have some thoughts on that.
Well, the poll numbers for Biden are very bad. He's even less popular, you know, at this point in his presidency than Trump was, and Trump was always very unpopular. You know, I think that a number of things happened. So some, you know, were developments that nobody foresaw and really probably couldn't do very much about. So the return of inflation. Inflation is hitting basically every country in the world. It's not just countries that have bad policies or are expanding their money supplies too quickly. It's really hitting everybody. These supply chain disruptions, you know, don't have a single source and they're affecting everybody. The pandemic, obviously, is something that we can't control. So you get these new variants like Delta and Omicron. And, you know, I think last summer, everybody was going back to work and meeting and going to restaurants. And then all of a sudden, you know, another year of lockdown happened. So those are things that have lowered the popularity of every leader in the world. And Biden is no exception. But I think that Biden has made some political mistakes. In the United States, we've got this complex electoral college system for electing presidents, which means that presidents are not elected by the popular vote. They're elected by the states, which tend to overrepresent certain smaller states, and especially states that tend to vote Republican. Biden, although he won majorities in both houses of Congress, had the slimmest possible majority. The Senate is balanced 50-50. You require the Vice President, Kamala Harris, to cast the tie-breaking vote in most cases, and their margin in the House is only about 10 seats, which means that if five of them turn over in November, then the Republicans will come back into power. And I think that now virtually everybody is expecting that the Republicans will take the House again in November, and they could take it by a very large margin. They may also take the Senate. And in that case, we return to the kind of gridlock that we had in Obama's later years, where the Republicans controlled Congress and the Democrats controlled the presidency. And, you know, all they could do was block one another. They couldn't actually agree on, you know, on doing anything important. And I think this has, you know, obviously big consequences for the domestic agenda of the Democrats, but it also has a big international impact because other countries see how polarized and paralyzed the United States is. And I think, you know, it's not an accident that the Russians are moving on Ukraine at this, you know, particular moment.
So are you concerned about the scenarios for 2024? Because I remember when we wrote the book, we had the conversations, we waited until the election result was ready when Joe Biden won, and we didn't get the storm of the Capitol. We didn't get that, but we got. You were kind of saying that now I'm coming out of some 4 terrible years, and it will be better. But I know now that it's not going to be that much better. So, what do you think are the possibilities for Trump or people? Well, Trump will come back.
That's really why 2021 was such a terrible year, because, you know, I think most people were expecting that Biden would win the election, that Trump would just fade away, that people would get tired of his divisiveness, and you'd get, you know, another set of Republicans who might be more moderate or more reasonable than Trump. But instead, and certainly nobody expected that Trump would not accept the result of the election and keep up this drumbeat of, false attacks on the integrity of the election. And that happened. Now, you could have hoped in late 2020 that the Republican Party, watching this kind of behavior, would say, we don't want anything to do with this guy who, you know, basically brought us to losing the presidency and both branches of Congress. But instead, they all rallied around him. And, you know, the overreaching that you saw on January 6th, the storming of the Capitol by this pro-Trump mob, in most countries, that kind of excess, you know, use of violence would discredit, the people behind this. And it did the opposite, you know, that the Republicans that wanted to tell the truth about what happened, like Liz Cheney, were basically kicked out of the party. And ever since then, the Republicans have been, you know, trying to put the most extreme, kind of pro-Trump people in positions of power so that the next time we have an election, they're going to be more sympathetic to, you know, declaring fraud even when it hasn't happened. So that's really the, unfortunate set of events that's taken place in the past year. I would say, in general, 2024 is still a long ways away. And so, its situation could look, quite different by then. But, at the moment, it doesn't look very good.
Well, we can't end on that. But I'll let the audience now come in with some questions. And when you prepare the questions for Frank here, I'd like you, Frank, to just reflect a bit on the last paragraph of your forthcoming book, which is Greek cardinal virtue that I believe you think we have forgotten. Can you tell us what that Greek cardinal virtue is and why it's really important? And then the audience might prepare questions and I can ask them to Frank if you don't want to ask them yourself. Go on, Frank, for the last paragraph of your
I'm sorry.
Yeah, do that and then we'll let them prepare questions.
The Greeks had 4 cardinal virtues. So they were wisdom, courage.
I didn't ask you to do all of them, but yeah, the most important one that I'm talking
but
about.
But the fourth one was moderation.
Yeah.
They have a saying in Greek, maiden agon, meaning nothing in excess. And I think that that is very much against the grain of the modern sensibility because, we tell our young people to follow their passions wherever they may lead. And we like people that push things to extremes. And I think that for both politics and in your personal life, the Greeks may have been onto something that, and I think it directly relates to the themes of my book. So, it's clear that economic freedom is a good thing. It promotes prosperity. But, eliminating the state from all aspects of economic life is not a good thing. Personal autonomy is something we all want and desire. But making autonomy, more important than any other kind of moral virtue, I think, is also pushing things to a unsupportable extreme. And so I think that you know, returning to a Greek sense of moderation is very important if we are going to maintain a liberal society in which, you know, people have the potential for violence and for violent disagreement, and the system is meant to prevent that from breaking out, and it's not going to happen unless you do have that sense of moderation.
So another question here for you from the audience is about what the common values are for liberal democracies and how we can define them and how to express them and to keep them going. So this is a question about national identity and the common values that has to build on.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think that the foundation for a set of common values has to center around the political institutions of liberal democracy themselves. That's the kind of idea that Jürgen Habermas had for a post-national identity for Europe, that it would be built around democracy itself. And it's not a crazy idea. I mean, if you look at France, you know, what it means to be a French citizen is basically to accept the principles and traditions of the French Revolution. So it's built around the ability to speak French, to understand French culture, but also to be Republican in the, you know, in the sense of the French Revolution, to believe in the principles of the rights of man and citizen, you know, in rule of law, in all of these other basically democratic principles. And I think the French have gone, a long way to, you know, there's obviously racism and exclusion in French society, but they have also been open to taking people that are not ethnically, you know, French and trying to assimilate them to, to that culture. Like I said, you know, India had tried to create such a liberal society, and unfortunately that's being reversed now under President Modi. But, you know, for 60, 70 years, they were pretty successful in creating an Indian identity that was based on, you know, largely liberal values. Now, the complicated thing is, you know, whether there are not some cultural attributes that, in addition to those, you know, liberal institutions, need to be part of an identity, because, you know, frankly, the emotional appeal of simply this kind of patriotism built around institutions is not satisfying enough to really bind a country together. And therefore, you know, you have other aspects of culture that are important. You know, in my book, Identity, I talked about the film Invictus, which was about the 1996 Rugby World Cup games that were held in South Africa. And, you know, the film is really about Nelson Mandela, who wanted to try to overcome the racial divide using sports, because at that time, we're under apartheid. The blacks played soccer or football, and the whites played rugby. You know, he set about trying to get his fellow black South Africans to root for the Springboks, the national rugby team, which at that point was almost entirely white. And you know, that's an example of you know, how you build a sense of identity in an inclusive way. So, you know, it has to do with these symbols. It has to do with a kind of shared history and sense of, you know, where the country is going, that, you know, it oftentimes involves food and certain other traditions. It becomes kind of complicated when those traditions are religiously based, because, you know, obviously people from other religious backgrounds aren't going to share that. But, you know, it's something that each society really has to, you know, has to work out in a very complicated way.
Well, Frank, we have been having a small conversation on the 24th of February that the listeners will listen to. And since this is a question that came up in the on the conversation that we had on the 26th of January, I will just repeat it and I'll hear your answers that you then said. So this is your answer from the 26th of January, and it's about Ukraine. So the question is, what about the situation in Ukraine today?
I think that it is very unlikely that there is any genuine sense of threat from NATO. You know, NATO had largely ceased being a military organization up until the invasion of Crimea in 2014. Since then, there have been some small deployments of NATO forces in the Baltics and in Poland and other places. But, you know, there's really nothing that NATO has done that can remotely threaten Russia. Certainly, you know, back in the Cuban Missile Crisis, you didn't have ICBMs that could hit American cities. And so therefore, putting a short-range nuclear missile in a place close to the United States really raised the level of threat very substantially. But NATO hasn't done anything remotely like this. You know, the weapons that it started to sell to Ukrainians are things like anti-tank missiles and anti-aircraft missiles that can't really be used offensively. And so I just think that, you know, this is a narrative that the Russians are promoting in order to justify their being able to do what they want to do, you know, creating this false sense of threat. And, you know, there's this tendency in the media and in Western publics to, every time there's an international crisis, to say, well, you know, two sides are fighting and they have to talk to each other and they have to listen to, you know, the fears and complaints of the other side. And I just think that that's really not what the moment calls for, because there was no threat to Russia prior to the, you know, to the Russians moving all these forces to Ukraine's borders. So I would say that it's really not NATO's fault at all. And I don't think that they should be sucked into a negotiation where the Russians give something and NATO gives something and they both meet in the middle, because this is a you know, really manufactured crisis on the part of Vladimir Putin.
Thank you, Frank. I know that you have a meeting coming up in 3 minutes, and I'm sorry to say that the last sentence you had here was not like, it's not very optimistic. Trying to get things to be optimistic, at least a little bit. But anyway, I think that your book actually ends optimistically. And I think that also in our conversations, in the book that they will be receiving in a couple of weeks or in a week's time, also has some optimistic things in it. So for the audience, I will just say, go and buy his next book and go into American Purpose and read his blogs and follow the debate there. And to you, Frank, it's wonderful to see you here. And even though we can't meet in person, we'll see each other on the screen. And it's been very nice talking to you today. Thank you.
And there is a Norwegian version of my book that will come out probably in the fall.
Yeah, that's correct as well. It will be translated into Norwegian in the fall. So that's also a good thing. So maybe we'll see you then, Frank.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Da får jeg si tusen takk til lytterne for at dere hørte på dagens episode. Jeg har allerede takket av Francis Fukuyama, og dere har altså hørt et opptak fra samtalen jeg hadde med ham på Solstrand-programmet i slutten av januar. Og tusen takk da også til Solstrand-programmet, som har latt oss få lov å bruke den samtalen til denne podcasten. Hvis du liker Liberal Halvtime, så kan du gjerne abonnere på sendingene våre i podcast-appen din, hvor du også kan gi oss tilbakemeldinger og rate sendingen eller tipse andre om podcasten. Du må gjerne sende en mail til matilde@civita.no eller til min kollega eirik@civita.no hvis du har noe på hjertet. Boken til Francis Fukuyama kommer som sagt til UK, kommer ut i Storbritannia den 20. mars, og så kommer den i mai i USA, og den er også ventet å komme i en norsk oversettelse til høsten. Så da er den tilgjengelig om ikke lenge. Takk for i dag, og velkommen tilbake.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.